Okay, I've started the audio recording for tonight, and I'm going to now do a mute all with the, again, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Welcome again to anybody who's just joining us for the first time and for old timers alike. I'd like to pass it off to Alan to take us through tonight's deck, and feel free to add additional questions into the chat window or ask audibly after we've gone through the main deck. Alan, over to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. As usual, we have quite a mixed bag tonight, so we'll get right to it. And I'm going to throw it right back to Chris, because the first item we have is a follow-up from Chris.
Yeah, I gave a Q&A about keystroke, and I've tried a number of different programs that allow you to highlight the position of the mouse pointer, and key and stroke was an interesting one. It also will show you if you're clicking on the left mouse button or the right mouse button or double clicking, or you're holding down a modifier key at the same time, which makes it really, really easy to demo things and train people over a Zoom session, for example. I did have a wish list, so I wanted that. There was one problem I ran into where if you're watching something like YouTube or a PowerPoint presentation where the mouse cursor disappears, the indicate mouse cursor position within key and stroke would still stay there, so you would see this circle that was highlighted. So, and also I thought it'd be good if they had user definable hotkeys that you could toggle on and off various features within the program rather than have to go through and pick them off of menus. And so I submitted those to the GitHub project, and I guess it was less than 2 months later, I got a reply from the author of the program, and he said it's been implemented and will be part of the next release. So mostly I bring this about to point out that if you see something in a piece of software that you don't like, complain about it. You might not get a change, but certainly if nobody complains, it's almost certainly not going to get changed. So open source projects and so forth are always very receptive to comments from the users and so forth. So you can help direct the way that some piece of software will be developed. That's all I have on that.
Hey, I'm sure that wasn't a complaint. That must have been constructive criticism.
True, yes.
Okay, so the next one is an upcoming item from Chris.
Yeah, so this is something I came across just recently, and VBA macros are a way that you can automate documents. And so VBA stands for Visual Basic for Applications. It's built into all of the Office applications. And so they can automate things, which is good thing. But unfortunately, the bad guys can automate malicious things, which is definitely a bad thing to have happen. Microsoft has been sort of sensitive to the fact that their Office applications have been abused by attackers and things like that. And so they're actually going to block VBA macros starting April of this year. And the old warning that you would have if you opened up an Office document that had macros, it would come up with a warning saying that macros have been disabled, but there's a button right there saying enable content. So you just click on that and the macros could run. In the future, what's going to happen is that it will just be blocked. And then if you want to actually enable the macros in that, you have to first off find where you've loaded that from on disk. You right click on the file in file manager or whatever and choose properties. And on the general tab, select the unblock checkbox and you click OK. And so it'll be a little bit of a slow down process, which is probably a good thing that people don't willy-nilly enable macros and only enable them if they truly need them. The URL is there for talking more about that particular issue, and I will paste that into the chat window as well.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And next up, we have a couple of Android applications. And I just remind everybody, if you have favorite programs, either for Android apps, or Windows programs, for example, and you want to share them with your fellow computer users here, feel free to let us know at suggestion box, and we'll do the honors for you. And speaking of which, our first share is from Tom. So, Tom, do you want to talk to How you go grocery shopping? You have to unmute yourself, though.
Maybe he's left the building.
Okay.
Oh,
there I am. Okay, this is a shopping list. It's there was a shopping list for the Palm Pilot that was nicer, and you could use it for all kinds of things. But this is a very grocery-centered. It comes with a big list of items which you can add to or delete or edit. And you can set up multiple stores and have a and your shopping list can then be turned on or off for particular stores. You can have aisles. I have them in here if you can. Doesn't like. If you have multiple stores that have items, you can have different types of stores, grocery stores, all with different lists, or the list can be shared so that if something is you indicated you want, then you can have it turned on in a particular store. You can have different prices for different stores and different aisles for different stores. And when you get your list of items that you want, they can be either desired or in your basket or purchased. And if they're in your basket and you put in the price and so on, then you can actually have a total displayed as to what you have in your basket. When you put in for a particular item, you can put in the quantity, the size, and this is can be just each, or it can be some kilograms or milliliters or whatever. And when you put in something like that, it gives you the price per. So I put all my stuff in as kilograms, fractions or of them, and then I get the price per kilogram. So it's easy to compare the prices between different stores. And in fact, if you go for shopping for something and you choose that and you choose to buy something at one store and you've indicated there's a lower price at another store, it will tell you there's a lower price at another store. You will have the aisle, which you can sort by. You can also have groups, such as what you can specify. You can say what they are, but it comes with a bunch of groups like dairy and frozen and about, I don't know, a dozen or more different groups. And you can sort by those as well, if rather than sorting by aisle. You can also use barcodes. You can scan barcodes to bring that item into your shopping basket or to or in your list. It also has priorities. You can add notes. It's pretty complete in terms of grocery shopping. And if you have an Android thing, I would suggest that it's probably good. I only wish it were as general purpose as my Palm Pilot application, which sadly is far in the past, because those lists could be used for all kinds of things, including packing lists and so on. But this is groceries, all groceries. Are there any questions?
I don't see anything so far, Tom, so thanks very much. And we'll move on to another shopping item from Stuart, which is fairly topical, I think, right now.
There we go. I've been using this app and website for a few years, actually. It's particularly when I was doing a lot of long distance driving, it was handy to check out what fuel prices were at different stations ahead of me on the highway. And, unless you've moved on to impulse power or warp cores in your vehicle, you're like me, you're stuck with gas, and we have to keep an eye on those prices because they seem to be getting pretty high today. I don't know about Ottawa, but we're averaging about $1.66 a liter here now in Quebec, or I should say Shawinigan.
Yeah, it's about 10 cents more than Ottawa right now.
So anyway, as the slide indicates, it's sort of a Wikipedia. Users generate the prices as they go by gas stations. And it really relies on honesty in reporting. Now, I know some people game the system, and some gas station owners may say we've got a better price than they do, even if they don't, but it averages out in the long run. The prices that one enters are only good for about 36 hours before they, if they're not updated or re-entered in some way, they just go blank. So you'll have to actually drive by the place to check it out. Or maybe phone, you know, gas stations in the list have a tremendous amount of information in their entries, which is the real benefit of GasBuddy. Even if you're driving an electric car, each gas station will have a tremendous list of amenities and services that you can get besides fuel. Does it have a bathroom? It's a big one. Are there air pumps? Is there a convenience bar? Is there propane? Is there... Well, it goes on and on and on. This service has been around long enough that it's got a full-featured website and a full-featured Android app and a Facebook page that I've never seen. But it's pretty handy. And if you enter prices, you can get, if you have an account and you enter prices, you get points that you can use to enter into contests for free gas. Now, you can't do that in Quebec due to some sort of legislative hoops that someone makes us jump through, but you can accumulate your points. And the only other thing you can do with these points in any province is once you get to a certain level, you're allowed to suggest edits to the master list of gas stations and features of those gas stations. So if your favorite gas station only has regular and premium listed, and for some bizarre reason you insist on putting in mid-grade gas and it's not listed there, well, you can suggest that they include that in the app so people can check that price. Or you can save it as a car wash. Or you can say that the bathrooms are filthy and haven't been cleaned in some sort of prehistoric time. So other than that, I don't really have much to say about it unless there's any questions. I know it's been around long enough. Most of you have probably heard of it in one fashion or another.
There's a bunch of comments. Bill says, yes, but he's great. He uses it all the time. Tom just says, bike. And Elizabeth wants to know, does GasBuddy list if they charge for air for bicycles?
I don't know. I have a compressor in my garage, so I don't care.
I've used GasBuddy a lot, and I've never seen that listed.
That's a good point, because they, up until a few years ago, gas or air was free, and I have noticed that the Shell down the road here, that you can even use your credit card for air now. How convenient.
I've always noting that GasBuddy has taken over a company here in Ottawa called Ottawa Gas Prices.
That was quite a few years ago. They took that over, probably over 10 years ago.
Yeah, actually, I think the regional websites are still... You have to plug in the address bar, ottawagasprices.com or .ca, and you will get the GasBuddy website. Similarly, here in Quebec, I have to put in QuebecGasPrices. Whatever it is, and I get the GasBuddy website. So it's
an interesting option, because I live in the East End, and I can check out Ottawa gas prices on GasBuddy, but I also have to check out Orleans, because I'm close to the kind of border of those two areas. And Orleans is often cheaper than the gas stations in or close to me in Ottawa. I imagine that's probably the case in other areas of the city where you've got these pockets of cheap gas stations.
That's possible. If you live near a border, that may be it. I did just remember one other thing I should mention. If you're using it on mobile, I only load the app when I'm about to check or enter a price, and then I unload it, close it, because it seems to be quite a data hog. Now, if you're on Wi-Fi, that's fine, but not everybody has Wi-Fi in their car. And if I just pull up GlassWire on my phone here, let me see. I've got, of everything I've used so far, my monthly plan, GasBuddy has used the most. I've used a total of 626 megabytes. I'm not a heavy data user, but anyway, I've used total 626 megabytes of data, and GasBuddy has taken 473 of it.
That's outrageous.
So turn it the hell off when you're not using it.
Yeah.
Oh, just use the website before you go out for gas. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, except it's not good if you want to enter a price when you're at the station.
True. Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. That's great.
There you go. Enjoy.
Bill says he pays $132.99. No, that's
that's expensive gas.
$1.32, I should think.
Yeah.
On one of the Indian reserves.
That's cheap.
Like $133 a liter? Wow.
No, I think it's $1.32.
Yeah, I assume so too.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. So moving on to the next, I think it's me. So I'm going to wrap up my series here on thinking about switching from Windows to Linux. And one of the things that we need to look at, and was suggested by Tom, was security. And there are two main things, I guess, you would consider: antivirus systems. And in Linux, that is not installed by default. So whereas Windows by default turns on Windows Defender, there is no equivalent AV product in Linux. And similarly, you've got Windows Firewall that runs by default. In Linux, there is a firewall, but by default, it is not activated. So those are a couple of things to think about if you're security conscious. However, if you read on the web, you'll find that a lot of people will tell you that you really don't need antivirus and that kind of stuff on Linux. But notice the word here in the title, usually. They say that there are a few viruses which actually attack Linux, and most of those are trying to hit servers. So they're not really interested in my little Linux desktop application. One of the good things about Linux is it doesn't have a very big market share, especially for desktops. So there's no real advantage in the big bad guys coming after Linux users, because there are just not many of us. Again, that doesn't necessarily translate to servers, because that's exactly the opposite. Most servers in the world run Linux rather than Windows. And they say that maybe Linux users are a bit more computer literate. That's the old geek myth. And the access to Linux software is very limited. Often you have to enter a root password to do anything useful. All the applications are in protected repositories, so unless you really go out of your way to download stuff from unknown third parties, then that's not really an issue. And there is some background security built in. But they do recommend antivirus of things like mail servers and people's sharing Windows file attachments. And you'll also find that you know, there are stories pop up in the news now and again, and this is a fairly recent one. Linux malware has increased by 35% in 2021, which sounds quite amazing. But when you read the details here, it's mainly targeting Internet of Things type devices, which are really interesting. These things are often, they have hard-coded credentials. So I take it that means that to log on to the system and activate their admin, it's a fixed user ID and password. Well, if the bad guys know that, then they can easily take over the IoT device. And then they also suffer from having open ports and unpatched vulnerabilities. And the really bad news is that if you have one of these IoT things in your house, then you're amongst 30 billion devices worldwide. So if the bad guys can take over a whole raft of these IoT devices, then they can clearly use them for things like crypto mining and denial service bots, that kind of thing. So it can be really bad. However, and the good thing I find about Linux is that you get a lot of security patches. But the one thing I like about Linux is that it's up to me to decide which patches I want, and typically I patch them all, but in more importantly, when I want to patch them. So I'm alerted that security patches and software updates are available, but I get to decide when these things are going to be installed. And typically, I mean, I do that first thing in the morning, but because there are only three patches today sort of thing. But at least I'm in control, which that's the one thing I really hate about Windows. And the other good thing, you notice that Linux differentiates very readily between things which are security updates and things which are merely software updates, for example. So it's a fairly robust system. And as I say, you get a fair number of updates. You get a fair number of kernel updates. I suspect that means that the Linux developers are really keeping tabs on all these exploits and shutting them down as and when they find them. So going back to Linux antivirus, this is probably the standard everybody knows about in the Linux world, a program called ClamAV. If you look at some of the details, it's an open source program. It has the general public license. It has a command line scanner. It has a GUI type tool as well. The virus database is updated multiple times per day, it says. And one of the good things, I guess, the bottom line here, that ClamAV is supported by Cisco. So that kind of gives me some confidence that this is a reasonable type program. And that being said, I don't normally use it, but if I do want to use it, you remember that you can run the software manager, you can type in something like clam, and then the manager will go through its database, and you'll find a whole raft of things to do with clam. And the one I picked was this ClamTK, which is a graphical front end, and I installed that. And then when you run that, this is kind of what you get. So you've got a whole bunch of things like settings and being able to whitelist various things. The bottom line is down here. I can either set it to scan an individual file or to scan a whole disk or a folder on that disk. And if I choose to scan a folder, then I can browse to the folder I want. And I've chosen to look at my OPCUG files, for example, and then run that program. It goes through and scans everything and basically says no threats found. So that's the way I would run ClamAV if I was really concerned about checking out Linux-based viruses.
Actually, before you move on from the antivirus, Alan, Lawrence pointed out in the chat that one advantage of running antivirus on Linux is so that you don't happen to share file attachments or files with other operating systems that only attack that other operating system. So you're not going to be accused of passing on a Windows-based virus to somebody who's running Windows.
Well, that's assuming that you don't share attachments with other operating systems.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, I dual boot my system between Linux and Windows occasionally.
Yeah.
And my data files are the same files on both operating systems.
Yeah. So running ClamAV is good in that regard, in that you won't be passing it on accidentally to somebody else who can get infected.
Well, except that if I'm bringing it in from Windows, and I've obviously downloaded it from in Windows, and it's run through Windows Defender, so it's probably clean anyway. But I mean, good point. I mean, yeah, it's not doesn't hurt to have multiple AV type programs running on different operating systems. That's for sure. looking at the firewall, if you check on the availability of firewalls on the web, you find in various forums you'll get messages like this that somebody's asking, does Linux Mint come with a firewall which is enabled by default? And somebody says, no, it comes with this one which you enable. And basically, he tells you to just go to the menu and go to the search bar here, type in fire as for firewall, and it finds Firefox. It also finds this thing called firewall configuration. If you run that program, then it pops up this screen. And here is a slider where you basically just slide this to the right and enable this firewall called uncomplicated firewall or UFW. And if you prefer the command line, then you can do that by using a root command, sudo superuser do. And then the UFW firewall and the enable command to run that. Then the final thing I have on security is using a DNS resolver. And if you look at Chris's article from October 2018, one of the programs he recommended was this program called Quad9. And Quad9 is a DNS system that basically looks up addresses that you're trying to access on your web browser, runs it through this 9.9.9.9 website and figures out whether it's malicious or not. If it's malicious, it will block the access or warn you or both, and that's a good thing. And this kind of applies to Windows also, so if you haven't done this, you might want to think about doing it. And the way you do it in Linux is probably the similar way you do it in Windows. You find the network settings, which is this little icon down here, and then click on the network settings. And that brings up a list of the Wi-Fi systems in your neighborhood, and my router is labeled as Duck Pond. So if I go to the IPv4 tab, then I can set my DNS as this Quad9, 9.9.9. And now all of my calls to the internet will be routed through this DNS resolver, and hopefully I won't fall prey to any bad things. And basically that's everything I have for Linux and how to move to Windows. So in October 2025, when your Windows 10 license expires, and you have no upgrade path to Windows 11, you might want to think about coming back to these various parts of how to run Linux rather than Windows, because that's certainly one of your options. Okay, that's all I have. I think, is there anything else in the chat?
No, just a comment, I guess, from Tom, that if you're looking at Mac OS, it's actually BSD, Berkeley, flavor of Linux underneath, so it's actually a similar certainly to Linux. And he says there's not a lot of difference between Linux servers and desktops, so server attacks may be more valuable, but they may still hit you even if you're running desktop.
Which is why I have a disk image backup.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on, then we have a share from Chris on external drives.
Yeah, this is a bit of an intriguing one. I'm not sure I have the whole answer yet on this. So when you go to remove an external hard drive or a flash drive, if you hover over the icon in the system tray, you get that tooltip pop-up saying safely remove hardware and eject media. And that was always the way that you should do before you remove it so that you don't end up with corrupting files on the device or anything. And so next. So if you click on that, you actually get a list of all of your external hard drives or flash drives. In my case here, I had a drive Z, which I use for file history and a couple of other things. And then I have a drive S, which is my backup drive. And then if you click on any one of those, you get this pop-up saying it's now safe to remove the hardware and you can safely pull it. So that's the way that things have been for a very long time. So do you really have to do that? And I say in the old days, definitely. So going back to, I guess, probably into the Windows 7 and before, definitely you had to do that because there could be cached information that's in memory that has not yet been written to the drive, and you pull the device out, and you have incomplete information that's been written to the drive, and you could end up as lost or corrupted files. So since Windows 10, actually, there we go. So since Windows 10 version 1809, which is, you know, 2.5 years, almost 4 years old, 3.5 years old now, Microsoft actually changed the default behavior for external storage, flash drives or external hard drives. And the new one is now, the new default is quick removal. And as is highlighted there, you can remove the device without using safely remove hardware process. And so the reason why they can do that is they change it so that Windows does not cache disk write operations anymore. And you can change this behavior so that it does cache information. And then you definitely have to use the safely remove to safely do this and not get corrupted files, and you could end up potentially with a little bit better performance. And the URL is there talking about that, and I've pasted that into the chat as well. So is it safe to pull it? You know, this article from Microsoft says that as long as you have this as the default setting of quick removal, you can remove the device without using safely remove. So that is as long as you don't have any open files on the drive. Okay, so if you have open files, you're not necessarily able to pull it because information may not have been written to disk. So my question is, of course you know whether you have no open files, right? And I don't know that I don't have any open files because there are applications that will open files that I didn't explicitly open. So sometimes when I actually try using the safely remove option in the system tray icon, I actually get a pop-up saying this device is currently in use. Close any programs or windows that might be using the device and then try again. So you get that, then something has got files open on that device. So what can you do about that? There is a program out there, a free program called Lock Hunter, which will tell you what programs are actually locking the drive. So if you install it, when you go into File Manager and you right-click on any file or folder or drive, you'll get a pop-up standard context-sensitive menu, and one of the options on there is what is locking this folder or file or whatever. So if you choose that, then you get an open window that tells you what has locks on the system. And in this case, I actually do have an open file that I open. So I'm using TextPad, my text editor, and I can see along there it tells me I've opened up /utils/longpath something. So I actually did have a file open. And so if I close that, then you know, I'd be safe. But would I be? Because System and Explorer also have a lock on that particular drive. What are they doing on the drive? Is it safe to remove it? I don't actually really know. Now, so I think if you have System and Explorer.exe that are open files, I don't think they should be of concern, but I'm not 100% sure. So I still think it's safest to use the option to safely remove hardware and eject media. And if you get that message saying the device is in use, I use Lock Hunter to see if I have any open files that I've explicitly opened. If it's not any files that I've explicitly opened, I'll go ahead and I'll pull the drive. Now, strictly speaking, the safest thing to do would be to actually log out or shut down and reboot to ensure that anything is actually open, is closed properly. But I don't actually know. So I still wonder a bit, you know, is it okay to pull if System and Explorer are locking the drive? I really don't know. I'd welcome word from anybody if you know for certain one way or the other whether it's safe to pull it if System or Explorer are locking the drive, because I see quite frequently that that's the case. Lawrence has a comment. Oh, Tom had a comment, yeah.
Yeah, he says the backup software has open files. I mean, I guess you'd know whether you're running a backup on them.
Well, I guess if you're reading, like you're backing up a flash drive or an external hard drive to something else, it will have files open for read. Certainly, if you're writing to the backup drive, then of course you wouldn't want to pull the drive while the backup is running.
What about automatic backups, like your file history or a schedule backup?
Well, that's my question. Is like, you know, what is it that is opening files in a lock state? Not for read only. If something opens things for read only, you know, it's not going to be a lock on the drive. When it has something that Lock Hunter says has a lock on it, it's because it's opened a file for its exclusive use. And, you know, I just don't know. I'm really not sure.
Lawrence says that he agrees that setting up laptops new and used, he's used a USB drive to install apps. And he's found that there's a delay before he gets the old clear.
Yeah. Very strange.
Stuart says he's never used Safe Eject. I always use Safe Eject. And my philosophy is, if Windows says that the device is currently in use, then the device is currently in use. So I wouldn't just pull the drive.
Yeah.
I wait until I log out or shut the thing down if that's the issue.
Yeah. I typically have just pulled it if I use Lock Hunter and there's nothing that I opened and I don't and it's obvious that it's or there's no obvious file that is open that I would worry about. Like if it's just System or Explorer, I end up pulling it. I've never had a problem. I've never actually seen anything show up on the list other than something I explicitly opened or System or Explorer, and System and Explorer never tell you what file is actually being locked. They just say it's the entire device. So I end up pulling it just because I don't want to reboot every time that I want to eject an external drive. But I really don't know.
So I'm wondering if there's anybody on the call tonight who's had a disk go bad because they pulled it out. And while you're thinking about that, we can come back to that if anybody's had it happen. We'll move on to the next issue, which is Bob Walker, who's going to tell us all about privacy policies for online systems.
Okay. First off, my internet connection seems a bit wobbly tonight. The joys of rural high-speed internet. But I'll try and get through this. I'll keep it short. First off, I'm going to paste the URLs for the presentation tonight into the chat bar there. And now I'll start the screen sharing. Okay, you seeing the full screen there?
Yep.
The title page?
Yep.
Okay, good. So we've been covering so far a few things in our series. Tonight is part six, the privacy policies of the internet giants and what they do with your information. I've added another thing at the end as well, because in doing the research for all the different parts so far, I've come up with some updates and everything. So I've added an update thing here for later on. As before, I'll be covering just the tip of the iceberg and pointing you to where you can get, where you can go for more information. And I'm doing that, more of that tonight than I usually do. In part one of privacy on the internet, we looked at why privacy was important, and we covered how the main threats to your privacy, as opposed to the main threats to your security, were from internet giants like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple. Now we're going to do a deeper dive on the internet giants and just what are their privacy policies, what information is collected, how is this information used, and who can access this information. Now, this is a list of the top websites with the most tracking. So when you go to any of these websites, you're bound to get a lot of trackers looking at what you're doing. And this comes from Who Tracks Me. They also list the tracker market share, and the biggest one of all is Google. And they make all most of their money from basically monetizing your information. Second one is Amazon, third one is Facebook. And Microsoft is down there at number five. Now this privacy policies table lists the some of the major websites or organizations. And it lists all the different things about how that they put into their privacy policies. Some of them, like WhatsApp, for example, which is a sort of video chat app, don't need to cover a lot of these categories because it's just not what they do. And if we compare the privacy policies of the different companies, there are three categories here. Privacy is, does their privacy policy actually protect your privacy? And in this category, we can see that in terms of protecting your privacy, the privacy policies from Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn, Snapchat, Amazon, eBay, and Hulu don't really protect your privacy all that much. The clarity is the privacy policy clear and concise? So Google is one of the prime offenders of at least their policy is clear and concise. And likewise, Microsoft is fairly good, Facebook and Reddit, but and some of the others. And then in scope, does the privacy policy cover everything it should? And here we get a wide range of things. Amazon is the worst offender because it doesn't cover very much. And you get a lot more information on this with the URL listed there, and it's also in the chat. Now, there's a lot of more information, and here's the URL here. When you go to this article or this story that's in the URL, for each of the different companies that were listed in the previous slides, there's 3 to 4 pages of information on their privacy policies in depth, but most important is what information do they collect about you, and how do they use that information, and who can access that information. So I started making slides of all this, and it ended up with about half a dozen slides per company, and there's about 20 companies there. So this would have been a really long presentation. So if this information is important to you, by all means, go to the URL and read it. And if you're interested only in a couple of specific companies like Google or Amazon, you can drill down just on those areas there as well. Another thing to keep in mind on how the companies use your information is that on a lot of websites, you have the option to access the site directly or through an account that you've set up on the site, or to access the site through Facebook, Google, Amazon, Instagram, etc. Now, as soon as you access the site through one of these third parties, you can be pretty sure they're tracking you. But that said, if a site has these options, there's a good chance that they're tracking you anyway as soon as you go to that site. And just a reminder, in the previous presentation on search engines and on browsers, DuckDuckGo has a feature where you can search through Google, and they say they sort of wander your search, but the reality is that DuckDuckGo may not isolate your identity and your searches as much as you'd like from Google, because there's still a lot of fingerprint information that comes through. There's other search engines that we mentioned in the privacy search engines presentation, specifically Quant and Swiss Cows, that do all our searches through Bing, which is a Microsoft application. And so they may not isolate your identity as much as you'd like either. And I said I'd keep it short and sweet tonight. So I've steered you to where you can go for a lot more information. And next week we'll look at can you remove your personal information from the internet? The short answer is no, but we'll have a look at what you can do anyway to try and do this. And if you download the deck, there's a good little joke thing here on ordering a pizza in 2022 from Google Pizza. So I won't go through and read the joke, but it's there for you. So that's it for tonight. Let me just stop sharing here.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Bob. There was one comment from Tim who's pointing to a PC Mag article, which he came across just today, I think. 3 hours ago. Google, I think it says Google to restrict cross-app tracking of users on Android. So they must have heard you, Bob, and they've taken note.
They're quaking in their boots.
Okay, well, we're in good shape tonight. So Chris had put a note in the chat window. If anybody has any questions or comments or things that they'd like to talk about, now is the time. So feel free to unmute your microphone and ask the question. I'll put something in the chat window.
Yeah, just a note on Chris's earlier talk on Safe Eject. I've always found it a little bit problematic. Sometimes you click on the icon and select the drive you want to eject, and you sit there and you sit there and you sit there, and sometimes you eventually get it a safe to eject, or a not safe to eject notice, and sometimes you get nothing. And when I click on the icon again, the drive has disappeared from the list. So I've assumed at that point it must be safe. And I've noticed in the last month or two, instead of getting the pop-up safe to eject, instead I get a notice in the notification bar. Sometimes in the notification bar, sometimes the pop-up, and sometimes nothing. So I find that it's a little bit problematic.
There was a question from B. Do you know anything about a search engine called Ecosia?
No, that's not one I've come across in the research. There, if you search on search engines, there's a massive number that
comes. It's used in the UK, and it's supposedly an eco-friendly search engine, and they supposedly donate to tree planting or something. It's used by some of the universities in the UK. I just wondered if you'd heard anything of it.
No, I can't say I've come across it before.
Nobody else is commenting on that one. There's a second question here, nothing to do with search engines, but Elizabeth says she has a work colleague with a notebook that converts her writing to a QR code. And it's called a lighting sheet or a lightning sheet. Is anybody any information on that feature? I've never heard of it personally, but I don't use QR codes. So.
Sounds kind of intriguing, but I have never heard of it before either.
I've never really used QR codes before, and I was hoping someone like Alan could give a brief lesson on how to do it. But
Tom notes that there are websites that will create QR codes, and I don't know what from. It's just for the QRcodegenerator.com is one of them.
Has anybody paid with their phone yet?
Like with, like Samsung has their Samsung Pay, and
yeah.
Google has Android Pay, and Apple has Apple Pay. I haven't. But
use Apple Pay.
Yeah. Is there something you're looking for in particular in the response,
Linda? I'm just curious if people have had a good experience, bad experience, if, you know, it's going to, if it's become very prevalent or it's still new or just, yeah.
I'm not quite sure, though. Are you referring to doing payments through software on the phone or using the NFC?
Like if I was, like if it's in a restaurant, like the restaurant today I went to said, oh, you'll be able to pay by your phone. And not to do banking, stuff like that. That's fine. But to actually do the transaction with your payment transaction with your phone.
You mean like tap to pay with a card?
Yeah, that kind of thing. But I didn't know how it worked.
I haven't actually used it yet, but I've seen people doing it all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, I've never used them myself either, but it's been around for quite a few years at this point.
Oh, okay.
I haven't heard of, you know, major issues with it or anything like that. I haven't heard of any issues with it, so I haven't heard any complaints of people saying that, you know, payments were abused or anything like that, but I'm not about to use it.
I just suggest you make sure your phone is up to date with security patches and
right.
Things like that. But,
yeah.
Which is easier said than done unless you're using an Apple phone, I think. And Elizabeth says it's quite easy with Apple. She has MasterCard set up and no problems so far.
Thank you.
Okay, we got something from Eldon. Oh, Stu, you're having a bit of background noise. If you can mute yourself.
Okay.
Thanks. So Eldon says he has an issue. He'd like direction on, please. When sending an email to some people, I've embedded more than one address for them, neither of which are in my contact list. Trouble is sometimes these people have addresses I've long ago abandoned, and I have no idea how to eliminate these invalid email addresses because they are not in my contact list. I think Linda's smiling. She's run into this. If you're using Outlook doing the autocomplete, one of the things that you can do is when an autocomplete address pops up, use the keyboard to highlight the entry and hit the delete key, and that should remove it from the autocomplete list. I don't know if that will work on any other mail platforms, but I know that that's how Outlook, like this is not Outlook.com. This is the full Outlook client running on your desktop.
I've been able to delete them from my phone too. Like it comes up and then I just hover my finger down and click the X, and it doesn't take it out of your contacts. It's already out of your contacts, but it takes it off that drop down list.
Yes, the autocomplete.
Yeah, the autocomplete.
Alan's saying he uses Gmail mostly.
Okay, Gmail, yeah, Gmail does autocomplete as well. But let me just actually try on here. So if I compose.
I'll try it on my phone.
And yeah, I don't, on Gmail, on the web browser, I don't see any way to remove it from the autocomplete list.
Yeah, and I can't figure out how to do it from my phone either. Whereas I have no trouble with my normal phone.
Because I just tried it with, and the autocomplete list comes up, and if I arrow to one of them, I can hit delete. It doesn't do anything. And right-clicking just gives me a web-based pop-up, so that doesn't help. So I don't know how to get rid of it, but I do know that, I'm pretty sure that the autocomplete list only comes from addresses that are in one of your contact lists. You can have multiple contact lists in Gmail, for sure.
Oh, I disagree, because I've had addresses come up that were just an attachment to an email. I've never written them to them in my life. I've never put them in a contact list. It just, stuff can pop up.
Hmm. Yeah, and it certainly seems like there's no easy way to remove them.
If I may, we're not talking about the Outlook app on Windows, are we?
Well, right now, no. Talking about Gmail. So, but this is something that had bugged me a little bit. So if nobody else has any answers, I might look into that. There's got to be other people complaining about it.
All right, sounds like something for a follow-up.
Yeah.
I think that I once saw in the settings, I don't remember where, that you can add any address. Like if something comes to you, it just automatically gets added into some maybe autocomplete list. It sort of rings a vague bell. So that might be something that is the issue. I don't know.
Yes.
Normally email programs, though, they add things like that to some kind of contact list, and you should be able to manage the contact list.
Yeah, and if it is a separate autocomplete list that is picking it up from, like Linda says, any email you've received, that it adds addresses to autocomplete list for that, there should certainly be a way of editing your autocomplete list to get rid of those that you don't want. I'll look into it. Hopefully next week I'll have something to say about it, even if it's only, I don't know, but I'll do some investigation into it and see if I can find out anything.
Okay, well, that's something to look forward to. All right, so that's basically our hour. So I think I'll go through the few slides I have as a wrap-up. because I got some stuff that we have some stuff we want to tell you about. So we are going to run a series of tech talks, one a month starting in April. These are going to be free for OPCUG members, but they're going to be very basic. So if you have friends, relatives, colleagues who are always bugging you as to how to do this and how to do that, maybe this is the time that you should ask them. Maybe they would like to join OPCUG and come to our tech talks. What we're going to do with the tech talks is make it free for members, but $20 for any non-member. But any non-member who pays us $20 to come to the tech talk will get a free one-year membership. And then they'll be a member so they can come to all of the tech talks. So it's a really good deal. We got some really neat stuff coming up, and we'll talk about that later next week. And if you look for the March newsletter, there'll be details of all of the tech talks in there. So if you're not a member, or you know somebody who's thinking about being a member, then this is a good time to join, because you can take advantage of these tech talks. If you join right now, it's an even better deal, because right now, if you're not a member, you pay us $20 for a membership, and we will give you a second year absolutely free. So you're getting two for the price of 1 year, 2 years memberships for the price of $20. Again, if you know anybody who's considering joining OPCUG, the offer's good until the end of March. And then all existing memberships are going to be extended for a year. And so that's how you get your second year absolutely free. Obviously existing members get the 3 year too. The board has been magnanimous in extending the membership years again for another year. And the final thing, we're going to see you all next week, because next week is February 23rd. And that will be our next Q&A session. So Chris will have all the answers to how to deal with your email contact lists.
Let's hope.
And hopefully somebody's going to send in some questions and some new shares. And we'll have a whole bag full of stuff for you next week, too. So that's it for me. And I'll turn it over to Chris to wrap up.
No, that's it. Thanks very much, folks, for showing up. And hope to see you here next week.